A new report from Human Rights Watch confirms that Ethiopia is forcibly relocating 70,000 indigenous people from Gambela. They want to make land available for foreign investment in large-scale agricultural plantations. The report says that when people lose their livelihood and are forced to areas where they can't feed themselves, hunger and famine are often the result. Entities including USAID, the World Bank Group, and major universities are often the architects of land deals that promise benefits for Africans, but often deliver food insecurity and displacement. Anuranda Mittal is founder and executive director of the Oakland Institute. It's an independent think tank that's put out a series of reports that show how institutions like Harvard and Vanderbilt reportedly used hedge funds to buy land in deals that could force African farmers out. With a round of publicity about the project, it now looks like Harvard is pulling out of a $500 million investment because of the work of the Oakland Institute.
Well, as a policy think tank, we have been looking at issues of increasing hunger. At the same time, we have seen food prices skyrocket, you know, in 2008, which came to be known as the food price crisis. 2008 is also the year that we started hearing about the financial crisis. And that's when, for the first time, this whole trend of foreign investors, whether these are rich but food insecure countries, at the same time hedge funds, private equity funds looking for new soft commodities to invest in, they started kind of being driven to poor countries which are resource rich otherwise with land and water. And we started hearing about this trend which has come to be known as land grabs, foreign investors taking over huge swaths of land in poor countries. At the same time, after initial concern that was expressed by United Nations agencies, we also started hearing from agencies such as the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, that this could be a win-win situation. This could be a situation which results in increased income, jobs for poor developing countries, while it also secures food supply for rich but food insecure countries such as the Gulf states or China.
Well, that sounds pretty good, doesn't it? I mean, if you're going to invest in land, you're going to grow more food, and then we're not going to have food insecurity anymore.
Exactly. But, you know, as a policy think tank, we felt that there were a few questions that had been left unanswered. For instance, everyone was talking a lot about availability of land, and Africa is a big continent. To be able to know which countries really have land available, what is being taken into account, for instance, how do you identify communal lands? How do you identify lands that are being used for fallow agriculture or are being left fallow for the next few years so people can do agriculture again on them? What about, you know, corridors for pastoralists? So we felt there were a lot of questions that were left unanswered. And while everyone was talking about increased income for these countries or increased job opportunities, we felt that we needed to do real research to be able to answer those questions.
Well, first of all, what did you find out about who was investing in the land purchases? Because a lot of times in the media, we see that it's maybe China's gone to Sudan and bought a whole big chunk of land. And it seems to be India goes to a place and buys a chunk of land. Is that who's doing this?
You know, that's a great question. When we embarked upon our research, thanks to the great work that media has done, we were hearing a lot about Southeast Arab. We were hearing about Gaddafi's investment from Libya. We were hearing about, as you said, the Indian corporations very active in Ethiopia. We have heard a lot about the Chinese activity in Africa. When we started a project, we were actually astounded by the number of private equity funds, hedge funds that are operating within Africa. These are firms which previously have had no history of being involved in agriculture, but they're seeing a whole new way of making profits and they're taking over these lands. But through them, because they're promising very high returns, somewhere from 20 to 40% returns, you have very unusual actors who are now getting involved in agriculture. It could be the Dutch pension funds. It could be very much our own Theocref. We found universities from Harvard University, Spelman College, Vanderbilt universities being lured by these promises of high returns who are putting their money in these very high-risk investments in Africa, which are promising very high returns. So a very unusual combination of folks came forward for us.
Now, it seems like a lot of them kind of contest your characterization of what happens with these land grabs. Emergent Asset Management says it's a catalog of inaccuracies, and Harvard University said, well, we don't comment on any of that, but people are kind of demonizing these development initiatives. How do you respond to what they've said about what you've said about them?
Well, you know, that's actually a great question again, because I think this conversation is not really about their word against ours. What the Oakland Institute has managed to do is be able to put forward what Emergent Asset Management, for instance, claims that it is doing in a very socially responsible way, investing in places such as Mozambique. We compared their arguments with their own documents. So, for instance, when they're talking about creation of jobs, we have put forward their own business plan where they are required only to create 18 jobs. Fieldwork, which actually shows that meeting with the community, which says, hey, we never gave away 2,000 hectares of land. We were forced to give 1,000. There's no way we can give the additional 1,000 hectares of land. And just for listeners, we're talking about 1 hectare roughly being the size of a football field. So we're talking about huge chunks of land which have been used by the communities living on the same plot of land for grazing the cattle, for growing food that their families depend on. So what we are doing is not an ideological debate. We are putting forward their business plans, their own lease titles, which show that you have moved into a community's home without their approval, without promising them anything, without any written guarantees what this investment will result for these people. And these people are not happy.
Well, then who is Emergent Asset Management and people like them? They're buying the land from the government, or if they're not buying it from the individuals on the land at times, who are they getting it from?
You know, it's a real issue because of the colonial history of Africa. Very often you find lands that people have been living on for centuries, for generations. They don't have, you know, this whole Western concept of private property. They don't have land titles to it. So, for instance, if you look at Ethiopia or you look at Mozambique, all land belongs to the state. So you find very often these sweetheart deals. For instance, in Tanzania, we found the largest land deal, which involves a U.S. investor who got it done through the prime minister. Even the opposition party or the rest of the parliamentarians in the country did not know about it. The villagers didn't know about it. Over 160,000 refugees from Burundi who have lived on that land for over 40 years did not know about it. So it is, there's a lot of secrecy around these deals. There is no open consultation process. And our question is, and would be to Emergent Asset Management, if these deals are resulting in such incredible positive benefits to nations, to communities, one would expect that people would know about it. You know, you don't hide things that you are, you know, you're proud of.
Now, I saw that a BBC reporter went out in Sierra Leone, and this was on a Swiss bioenergy company's land. They're producing sugarcane there to produce biofuels. And they found someone who worked on the farm and said, you know, that's terrific. I'm gainfully employed. I received about $70 a month. Before that, I spent a whole year without getting $50. So that was someone who thought he was benefiting from this sugarcane field there. There are people who might be benefiting.
Sure. I mean, I think what we have managed to do with our research is definitely to show that when you have, and these are figures accepted by the United Nations, that if you have a piece of, you know, arable land, a family can sustain on 2 to 5 acres of land. So when these large industrial agricultural plantations are coming in with the technology, they're mechanized. So they're not creating the same kind of jobs that you would hope for the large number of people, especially when most of the people in that area depend on agriculture for their livelihoods. So, for instance, I mentioned Emergent Asset Management, you know, which is required to create 18 jobs in agricultural fields. This is the kind of work that the local community does know of. But it's a village of 7,000 people that use that land to feed their families. So you might create 18 jobs that pay a little bit more than what the people did before. But in reality, what we found, the people saying, most of them, we don't have those jobs. And this is not just about Emergent. I was in August in South Sudan, where 250,000 fedans of land are being cultivated by an Egyptian firm called Concord Agriculture. And meeting the local people, the biggest grievance was that we were promised jobs, and there are no jobs. And they have hired people, but they're predominantly Zimbabwean South Africans. So they're not necessarily creating jobs that were promised. We did look at the ADEX bioenergy deal in our country report on Sierra Leone. And yes, you know, thousands of jobs were promised, but when you actually start breaking down the numbers, you find that the jobs are minuscule compared to the loss that the community faces in terms of loss of land, loss of access to water, and broken promises that they're left with.
You're listening to Worldview on WBEZ. I'm Jerome McDonald, speaking with Anuradha Mittal, and we're talking about the Oakland Institute's report on understanding land investment deals in Africa. I was talking with a governor from the new state of South Sudan, and you did a report on South Sudan, and he had issues about who was selling land and who was buying land where he was governor. He said people were claiming land ownership who didn't necessarily own the land that they were selling to the Chinese where he was. He thought it was a really serious deal, but he wasn't really equipped to really put the hammer down on the whole thing.
Sure. You know, in South Sudan, it's very interesting because this country is the newest country in the world. It became independent in just this July. But at the same time, over the last 4 years, this country has seen nearly 8 to 10% of its land bought or leased by foreign investors. So here is a country which has less than 40 kilometers of paved road in the whole country. Here is a country where ministries have basically not even gotten off the ground. There's complete absence of regulatory framework. But at the same time, foreign investors have been lured in, you know, driving in hordes, whether it's the Indians or the Chinese or the U.S. investors and the Europeans, who are basically hoping to make a killing. And we found several deals. For instance, near Juba in Lenya County, we came across and exposed a deal which involves a U.S. investor, Howard Eugene Douglas, a former U.S. ambassador, who through Kenyatta Development has a deal for $25,000 for 600,000 hectares, and it can go up to 1 million hectares of land. They have the right to clear any precious woods on it. They can grow agrofuels on it. They can even do gold, oil, petroleum exploration underneath the ground. When we released the contract in June, that's the first time the community that lives on the land heard about it. And this deal was supposedly made in 2008 with a cooperative that does not exist. So there's a lot of confusion and secrecy and things being thrown together. And unfortunately, because this trend is getting such a push as a development paradigm by agencies such as the World Bank Group, it does not create that necessary policy space that's needed for governments to be able to invite investment, but invite investments within a regulatory framework that results in benefits for these countries, at the same time results in some benefit for the communities who are giving away a lot. For instance, the land that they live on and the land they need to feed their families.
Now, how many people were affected by that one deal in South Sudan?
Well, you know, it was an interesting deal because I mentioned Lenya County, but the area that this investor managed to get goes beyond that county. So we are talking about thousands of people being impacted and falling into different counties and one small cooperative saying involving three individuals that they have signed off the deal. So these are many instances like that where you find that no process has been gone through, no environmental social impact assessments have been done, and more important, no figuring out has been done that how many people would be impacted. There are no figures for any of that.
And what exactly was the idea to develop that land? Is there a strategy there?
Well, as I said, this deal was struck upon in 2008. In June, when we came out and released the contract, and it resulted in a BBC program about the whole foreign investment deal, that's the time when the community heard about their lands having been given away, sold, leased for 50 years to a U.S. investor. So when I was in South Sudan in August, actually it was a beautiful moment when community members had traveled to Juba with letters from community elders, from their chiefs, basically saying that this deal is illegal and should be voided. And nothing has happened on the land so far. It is basically investors going, grabbing lands, just sitting and waiting to see what happens. And what we did find, that while claims were being made for agricultural development to do agrofuels, the real intent, which we were informed by the business partner of this investor, was really to do gold and oil exploration. And as a result of this opposition from the community, the president has declared that this is now a free country. South Sudan is a free country. And if people say no, that deal stands voided. So it will be a real challenge for the investor to move ahead with any kind of plans for that area, because the community is very organized and very clear in its message that this is our land. We fought with Khartoum for many years, not so that somebody else can come and take that land away from us.
Now, the United States was so involved in the negotiations that created South Sudan, and you mentioned that the managing director of this Texas-based global business development partnership was a former U.S. ambassador there.
Well, you know, in case of South Sudan, we have actually seen that a lot of former actors that were involved in so-called aid or supporting South Sudan are now back in. These expats are back in, looking for basically lands and deals, the kind of thing that Khartoum had done before, and it is kind of unfortunate. In fact, our research also shows that agencies such as USAID are really pushing South Sudan to move forward to become more investor-friendly. What instead really needs to happen is to first put in place a regulatory framework that could handle this influx of investments. So in fact, 14th and 15th of December, USAID organized a conference for South Sudan where investors showcased agricultural and other potentials of South Sudan. And it is kind of scary because on one hand, it's true, the world's newest country does need support, does need investments. But without a regulatory framework, it could lead to absolute chaos and the country could descend again into violence.
After the break, Anuranda Mittal tells us more about the powerful players involved in land deals in Africa. I'm Jerome McDonnell, and you're listening to Worldview from WBEZ. You're listening to Worldview on WBEZ. I'm Jerome McDonnell, speaking with Anuradha Mittal, head of the Oakland Institute. We're talking about the Institute's report on understanding land investment deals in Africa. Well, let's swing over to a different example. You've done some work in Tanzania. Can you tell us about Agrisol Energy there?
Sure. Agrisol Energy, the face really behind Agrisol Energy is Bruce Rastetter, who owns Summit Farms in Iowa. But Bruce Rastetter is a very prominent Republican who has been in the news, for instance, using a nonprofit to run campaigns against the Democrats in support of Republicans in the last elections who would support ethanol subsidies. Mr. Rastetter used to have the third largest ethanol plant in the country called Hawkeye Energy. Mr. Rastetter is also on the Board of Regents of Iowa State, and the deal that we came across is actually the largest land deal in Tanzania. It is for 325,000 hectares. We're talking about 800,000 acres of land, which investors and others have been told that it is an abandoned area. Nobody lives on it. Iowa State University has worked to do feasibility studies, rainfall patterns, basically showing it's a great place to do agriculture. When we started our research, what we learned, first of all, which was most shocking, is that in the name of bringing development to Tanzania, this whole project, which had started off in 2008, is on grounds which are not abandoned. They have been housing over 160,000 refugees who came to Tanzania over 40 years ago. These are generations of people who have lived there, who have made that land fertile. It's a very strong community. In fact, the largest church that there is anywhere in East Africa is there, that has been built by this so-called refugee community. But now they are being told that they need to move away from the lands. They'll get $200, and before they go, they have to break down their homes. Because this is not like some, you know, refugee camp you and I might think of, you know, those plastic tarps. We are talking about townships. We're talking about real homes. These are people who pay taxes, who have shops. They're growing food. In fact, they only have 4% of the area, but they produce 40% of the food that's eaten there. So these are very productive people who will be displaced. They'll be divided into four or five families, spread all over the country, dividing the community all over again.
And these are people who are originally from Burundi and have been there for 40 years?
Yes, this has been one of the people who came there. They have settled there. The children have been born there. So they're hardly refugees. They're actually already Tanzanians without papers and very productive members of the community. Now, this project would displace these people. When we came out with that investigation, we put forward their feasibility reports, their business plans. That's the first time people of Tanzania heard about this deal, whether it is, as I said before, the opposition party, whether it is the parliamentarians, whether the nearby villages. Nobody knew who was going to move in. Secondly, while we keep hearing about claims of benefiting Tanzania, when we look at their business plan and did the numbers, what it really shows is a net loss for Tanzania. Tanzania will have to agree to allow AgriSol to come in and not have to pay import duties for, you know, the seeds they bring in, for the big machines they bring in. They don't have to pay profit taxes for several years, all kind of tax holidays. They can repatriate their profits. So for a company which is claiming to make, say, invest $100 million over a period of 10 years, this is also a company, if it grows just corn, given the prices of corn in May, would make net profits of over $300 million per year. And with the ability of, you know, these tax holidays, will leave nothing behind for Tanzania. They are asking the government to change the policy framework so they can grow GMO corn. So it would completely change how agriculture is done in Tanzania. They want to grow corn for ethanol. So you're going to use fertile lands that have fed people so you can grow ethanol for export to Europe and to America. I mean, it's a long series of just things, but really the fact that people don't even know about it, they don't get to actually decide what is good for the development of Tanzania or for their own communities, is appalling. This is not what democracy looks like. This is not how we do development projects in a place like United States of America. This is basically setting a whole different standard for how we do things in Tanzania.
Now, it's interesting the contrast between Tanzania and Sudan. In Sudan, obviously a brand new country, no regulatory infrastructure. You would think Tanzania would have a few things ironed out by now.
Well, sure. I mean, and actually Tanzania, in our country report we show, is a country which has, you know, made a lot of progress. For instance, they have a biofuel policy. In fact, our research also showed that some deals which were done in a more democratic way, which involved participation by public, were actually cancelled because they felt it would not be good for the community. The problem is when these deals are pushed by higher-ups in secret with the whole myth of, oh, it'll create jobs, it'll be good for the country, and they're just snuck through. For instance, in the case of AgriSol, this deal was struck at the highest level between the Prime Minister, the Minister of Internal Affairs, who would be responsible for refugee affairs, is now a legal advisor to AgriSol Energy. The AgriSol Tanzanian partners, a former Minister of Trade and Industry. And then you have a very prominent Republican leader, Bruce Rastetter, who is in the news because Republican presidential candidates are going to Iowa to meet him, to get his blessings and to get campaign support. So when these powerful people come together, it is not just an attack on the livelihood and well-being of people in places like Tanzania, it is an attack on democracy and security worldwide.
Aren't there investment rules out there that would restrict this kind of investment? Isn't there something that kind of goes beyond laws in Tanzania or South Sudan that kind of sets up rules of the game for buying land?
You know, that's what you and I would think, because, yes, there need to be rules and regulations. But at the same time, the pressure that we are seeing as a development paradigm, that large-scale commercial plantations will feed the world, or this is good for national development, or this will result in more jobs, countries are being told to get rid of a lot of regulations, that they should become, you know, investor-friendly. If you look at World Bank Group, it does a doing business ranking. So it ranks you if you're a good place to do business with. And those rankings are not based on if you have good environmental laws, if you have good, decent labor laws. They are based on basically not having those regulations. So, for instance, according to the International Finance Corporation of the World Bank, the best country to do business with is Georgia. Because you don't have regulations, you don't have a lot of legal processes which would become what investors might consider a hindrance. So given that scenario, given that push for development paradigm, we are seeing countries abandoning legal frameworks, policy frameworks, which would protect the rights of the communities, which would ensure free, prior, informed consent, which is a basic principle in performance standards of the International Finance Corporation, or if Equator Principles is followed upon.
You're listening to Worldview on WBEZ. I'm Jerome McDonnell, speaking with Anuradha Mittal, and we're talking about the Oakland Institute's report on understanding land investment deals in Africa. How should a listener weigh investment in land deals? I'm sure there's some that are working out as advertised and that do work. Everyone says, well, Africa's economies are growing now, and it's working out better, and they say kind of some of the things that you are faulting are actually the assets and why Africa is growing now. And I noticed the consultancy group McKinsey had a report on Africa, and they said African governments are increasingly adopting policies to energize markets. They privatized state-owned enterprises, increased openness of trade, lowered corporate taxes, strengthened regulatory and legal systems, and provided critical physical and social infrastructure. They go on to talk about countries that are privatizing and striking free trade agreements, and this is a good thing that is the main reason why Africa grows.
Well, sure. I think if you really care about if these investments are also good for Africa, you don't want to make a loss, but you also want it to be good for Africa, I think we have to start by questioning what we mean by economies are growing. You know, you could have many more divorces in a country with people buying two homes, two cars. That'll be good for economy. You have more oil spills with cleaning operations and all of that. Economy will grow. But does that necessarily mean well-being of people and communities? That's a whole different question. Because on one hand, we can say, yes, investors are being lured into Africa. But last time I noticed, famine in East Africa has been on almost every media channel and every media outlet. It is no longer a secret. We are talking about investors rushing into Ethiopia so they can grow cereals and cut flowers and agrofuels on its fertile soils, while 13 million Ethiopians are still dependent on foreign food aid. While we're talking about Sierra Leone and investors rushing in there, such as Addex Bioenergy, to use its soils to grow agrofuels, this is a country which ranks one of the lowest in the UN Human Index and its food index. So we really have to talk about what does it mean when economy grows? Does it trickle down to all? And that is the question that we at the Institute are asking, because at the Oakland Institute, we are not against investment. We are all for investment. In fact, one of the major reasons for poverty and hunger in Africa is that over the last 3-4 decades, African countries have been told to not be invested in agriculture, to get out of it, to not have credit schemes, to not have any kind of support for the smallholder farmers, not have any kind of subsidies. But the kind of subsidies that are now being offered to these foreign investors, not pay taxes, you know, they're even building railways. In the case of Tanzania for AgriSol, that's what they would have to do, build a railway line to where their project would be. The kind of infrastructure support that has never been provided. It is no rocket science that just by putting money somewhere does not result in improved food security, does not result in more jobs. So a conversation has to start in terms of what kind of investment would really benefit people of Tanzania or South Sudan. What will really create jobs? What would build assets for the communities, not just for foreign investors?
I imagine some people are listening and thinking, boy, this is so complicated. These guys are going through international deals we don't know anything about, and they feel a certain sense of helplessness about it. I mean, what can we do to stop this guy in Iowa from going to the prime minister in Tanzania, cutting a deal, and nobody gets any input? It's a little bit about what is wrong with our governance system and how people kind of get into deals like this. And no one can do anything about it.
Actually, you know, when we started our work and we started finding just egregious human rights abuses, or like the case of AgriSol, it was very distressing because it was like, wow, we know so much and what do we do? I mean, what do you do with this information? It kind of makes you feel, you know, helpless and despair. But one of the biggest things that we learned, it's like really like a Dracula. When you drag it out into the sunlight, it has no place to hide and it has no place to run. I mean, the research that the Institute has done, I'm very proud to say, has completely reframed the debate on investments and how they happen in land. It has also resulted in real concrete successes. For instance, I mentioned the deal in South Sudan where the president is saying and supporting the local community and saying, if you oppose this deal, you were not involved in it. You know, it stands voided. This is a free country. In case of Tanzania, even AgriSol, they have not been able to move forward because once we came out with those documents, there's a huge debate happening in the parliament. The shadow ministers are questioning the prime minister. You know, thousands of people have written letters to these investors and the Tanzanian prime minister, with majority of them being from within Africa, saying, you know, divest from this project, walk away from this investment. It is wrong. Even Sierra Club, on behalf of its millions of members in Canada and United States, wrote to the Tanzanian prime minister and wrote to this investor. So it is basically this thing that we started with. We have been surprised. Harvard University, which has a policy of not talking about its investments, Emergent Asset Management came out and talked to Business Insider and said that as of now or currently they're not invested. We believe that Harvard University has pulled out from its investment in Emergent Asset Management. They don't verify that because they just don't talk about the investments. Students at Harvard, students at Vanderbilt have been organizing and demanding, on one hand, transparency, but also saying that if you have nothing to do with agriculture, you should not be investing in agricultural project in Africa, which is not controlled by the Africans, which does not benefit the Africans. So actually, people in the United States are feeling very empowered, because the truth of the matter is that the Africans don't have their money invested in pension funds and they don't have their monies invested in university endowments like that of Harvard. It is us, and we can dictate and control what happens with our monies and how they are used and what impact they have on the communities in Africa. And lastly, I would say the media. I mean, I'm talking about mainstream media from BBC to New York Times to Guardian to WBEZ. You have put this issue out there. People are far more informed. And as I said, it's a Dracula. Once you drag it out for people to look at it, it has no place to hide and it has no place to run.
Have you completely changed your mind about agri-fuels, biofuels? I mean, it sounds like these companies really are going in and preying on the vulnerable at times.
Well, you know, for us, it's a real concern because agri-fuels, which have been so promoted both by European countries and by the United States to kind of reduce a dependency on foreign oil and to do things differently in the name of doing things green without having to change our lifestyle, is resulting in a big lifestyle change for people, say, in Africa, because very fertile lands are being taken over to grow agrofuels, not to mention a lot of these crops that are used for agrofuels, jatropha, sugarcane. These are big water guzzlers. So they're not just grabbing land, but they're also grabbing valuable water resources of Africa. So again, it comes back to that instead of just finding a quick green consumer solution, we need to be educated in terms of where it comes from, our agrofuels. If lands are being used in poor developing countries, it's a real issue because it's taking away fertile agricultural lands which need to be used to feed people, not to feed our cars or airlines.
Do any of the agribusinesses come at you and say, well, if we don't buy the land, the Chinese will, and they're not going to be as responsible as we are. This is a deal we should cut.
You know, that's very interesting. In fact, I think it was in Tanzania, some of the people from within AgriSol suggested that. You know, we have looked at over 50 land deals in over 7 countries. And I think China gets a little bit too much of the bad name. I mean, we had Secretary Clinton in May, June, speaking in Lusaka at an investment forum, warning Africa of the new form of colonization that's coming. She was sharing the platform with Susan Payne, CEO of Emergent Asset Management. So I think if you start looking at who's going in and putting in infrastructure, you know, the Chinese are actually doing that. Now, does that make their investments, if rights are being violated, if lands are being taken over that people did not agree to, if they're bringing in their own labor? No. But the question here is not one of pointing fingers at each other. If we don't, the Chinese will. The debate really needs to be if we are people who claim to be caring for Africa. I mean, United States, its people, Americans send the largest number of checks to support causes of famine, of drought, of war in places like Africa. If we want to make lasting change, the only way to do it is not to kind of keep China there. We need to start bolstering the ability of countries within Africa to have policy frameworks that can protect their people. And also, let's not forget, how did America do well? How did places like Germany or even the Asian Tigers do well? They did well when there was heavy state involvement in both agriculture as well as industry. So if our intent, our real goal is to help Africa develop, we need to encourage governments not just to privatize and sell off all their assets, including their water and their land and their gold and everything else, but really support those governments to be able to work with the communities to have enterprises which really focus on development of these countries rather than promising just high returns to investors.
Now that you've been at this a while, was there anything that ended up surprising you in these deals as you looked at deal after deal and some of the people involved surprised you? What kind of thing jumped out at you that you never expected to happen?
You know, it is hard to kind of pinpoint just one thing. I think for me, the biggest surprises was the level of greed. Yeah, I think, you know, any decent human being, whatever political ideology you believe in, when you start looking or you meet a family like I did in Mozambique, where the father and the grandfather says, you know, looking helplessly, "I don't know what to do. My family is starving. We're in hunger season because the land that I grew food on is no longer there. I'm waiting for my neighbor to be done so I can use his field to grow food for my family." When you hear that and you look at the greed of a company that's taken over lands at promising 40% returns, I just could not wrap my head around it. Or in Mozambique, again, I met these women farmers who talked about a foreign investor, Mia, which had taken over the lands. One day, you know, bulldozers showed up and these women said, "But look at our fields. We have standing corn. We have always grown food there. How can the land not belong to you?" And they said these people flew planes very low over the fields and they didn't know what they dropped, but the crop was burnt. That was shocking, that how greedy we can be. Or talking to, you know, the chief investment officer of Vanderbilt University, I asked him about emergent asset management and about if they had done due diligence on the claims of emergent on doing socially responsible investment. And he very candidly said to me that his primary objective is not socially responsible investment. His primary objective is to make highest returns. You know, one would expect to hear that from the 1%, but to hear that from a university official in the United States, that was very distressing.
Anuranda Mittal is the head of the Oakland Institute, and you can read their report online. It's Understanding Land Investment Deals in Africa. There's lots of different land briefs you can check into. Thanks a lot for joining us and doing this work.
Thank you very much. A pleasure.